Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. Over the next hour, we're going to be looking at some stories making the news in business and politics at home here in Ireland and right across the world. On today's show, the European Central Bank Council were in town at Mount Juliet this week. So I'll be speaking to Martin Arnold from the Financial Times in Frankfurt about what we learned after their meeting. We'll also be talking about a row that happened around that meeting about national staffing numbers at the heart of the central bank. And down the road, there was yet another summit held this week in Killarney. It was called the Global Economic Summit, a mini Davos, if you like. It's where the great and the good of politics in business met, and they talked about our future. Artificial intelligence was a hot topic down there, I'm told, and Charlie Taylor of the Business Post was there, and he's going to be joining us later to share the groundbreaking opportunities that he discovered about AI at that conference. And over in the UK, a star-spangled election looms on the 4th of July. But why now and what next for Rishi Sunak? Well, Mark Paul will be joining us from London to tell us what the reaction was like on the ground to the shock news this week. And finally, Susie Farrell from Addison Recruitment will be here to tell us all about working in the corporate affairs sector. And she's going to be providing some top tips for anyone who's looking to break into that world. If you want to contact us about any of the items on today's show, or indeed any ideas for another show, you can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Now, corporate affairs is something that many of us don't think a lot about, but it's actually something that is embedded in most large companies nowadays. So we're going to talk a little bit about what the role entails and find out more about what role it is actually within an organisation. And I'm delighted now to be joined by Susie Farrell. She is a founder of Addison Recruitment and she joins me here in studio now. Susie, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Mandy. Delighted to be here.
Now, Susie, look, that corporate affairs position, what exactly is it and how or where does it sit within a company structure?
I guess the first thing I'd say is that corporate affairs is a very, very broad term, which includes a number of functions that do sort of fall under communications. So it includes internal communications, external communications, media relations, crisis management, public affairs and government affairs. In some cases, the corporate affairs function can also include investor relations, ESG and sustainability. But I guess that just depends on the sector that you're speaking to. But I guess one thing I'd say is that as a function, it's definitely evolved considerably over the years. It's not just comms. So, and I think a lot of people would see corporate affairs as just comms, but now it actually adds a lot more to an organisation.
So is it more like public affairs then, where the stakeholder management, that external piece of managing reputation and relationship at a higher level is more important than, say, the PR element of it?
Well, it's interesting point to make just about, leading the conversation, because it is very much corporate affairs does lead the conversation with a number of different stakeholders. So and those stakeholders can include your people, so your employees. It can include government stakeholders, suppliers, often regulators, investors. So it does actually lead the conversation with all these, I guess, with all these relevant people. And I guess what they're trying to do is very much act as the eyes and the ears and lead the conversation. So it's all about very much assessing risk and opportunity for a business, which it all, I guess, in an effort to very much protect their image and their reputation.
Mm. And why is it important within an organisation? Is it because the evolving compliance governance landscape is growing for them that you need someone like this to kind of see around the corners ahead of time at what your potential risks might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think the world is changing and the business world is changing. There's a lot more complexity and you very much need somebody who is going to, I guess, be able to be part of the conversation at the executive table and be expected to probably think and actually operate quite differently to everybody else. I think a good leader in corporate affairs is somebody who can kind of connect those dots. So connecting the dots in terms of the commercial objectives, the longer term strategy, their behaviour, the reputation of a business. And there isn't really, if you look at the roles across an executive team, it's a corporate affairs director who actually does that because they're managing the message, because they're trying to protect the image and the reputation. So I guess someone who's a good leader in corporate affairs is somebody who can you've mentioned it there, seen around corners, you know, they're able to think of several steps ahead. They understand risk, but they don't always have the answers, but they are somebody who asks very good questions.
So I'm just trying to figure out where they would sit in an organization, because it sounds to me like in order to do all of that, to have that management skill set, to have the experience, you've got to be quite senior.
Yeah.
So where does it sit in the organizational structure? And probably more importantly, what type of person do you typically see in this type of a role?
So, to start with, in terms of where they would sit in a structure, we are seeing more and more the function is reporting into a CEO, hasn't always reported into a CEO. But the interesting thing is that it doesn't necessarily sit on an executive committee. And that's what probably the function is has over the years been trying to sort of elevate its position, because it should be sitting at the ExCo. You know, the profession is on the up. We're seeing, obviously, there's way more complexity and challenges that an organisation needs to navigate in the business world. And I guess I'm a real advocate in that corporate affairs needs to sort of, I guess it needs to be in those conversations. It's dealing with the CEO, it's dealing with the chairman, it's dealing with shareholders. It's very difficult for them to do that if they don't have a position on the executive committee. But we're probably still only seeing the growth in being able to achieve that. So
you're somebody who's worked in recruitment all your life, and that's an interesting point that you make about where they sit and how maybe that should be elevated, because we do see that some roles within organisations are kind of prominent and become dominant at different times. So, for example, during COVID, we saw the HR function was a massive issue. And now I think it's more respected throughout all of the organisations, because, you know, we're still trying to manage the legacy of COVID and that hybrid working.
Yeah.
Technology as well. We spoke to somebody here last week from EY, was talking about how now technology kind of it goes through every single department in some way or another, thanks to AI.
Yeah.
So in terms of corporate affairs, it's probably why, and that's why we wanted to do it today, is we're hearing more about it, but not a lot of people maybe understand it. So maybe talk us through, or I know you have some research that you wanted to talk about, some research that you've done about what are the traits of people who go into this profession and who are successful. So maybe take us through those.
Yeah. We have just published a report, and look, I'm a member of the Corporate Affairs Search Alliance, which is a group which was founded 3 years ago. Essentially, we are six, just to quickly give you sort of the context, we are six corporate affairs search firms operating in different markets. And we're all very, I guess, passionate about the function. We want to really see the function elevate its position, and we want to sort of, I guess it's about trying to make corporate affairs better. So, and we have recently just produced this report, which it initially started with interviews with 23 corporate affairs directors, and these directors are based in the US and the US and the EU, and essentially, we wanted to understand and bring a new perspective on what good corporate affairs looks like, and I guess what are the leadership skills that they need. So it's not about so much about the what, it's about how they do their job.
Okay, and then what type of people did you look at here, and what did you find from the research that you conducted?
So we spoke to, in terms of the, I guess, the participants from Ireland, they came from, you know, from different industries between retail, FMCG and financial services. And they're all exceptional corporate affairs directors, very good at what they do, you know, at the top of their game. And I guess in terms of, you know, putting together this piece of research, we were able to look at the blueprint for sort of understanding what the role is and what contributes to the success of a modern corporate affairs leader. Which actually includes five characteristics. So, and this is what obviously the report is very much about.
Okay, so what are those characteristics then?
So the five traits are, first, there's a catalyst. So this is somebody who can very much move mountains, can unlock new ways of thinking. I've actually very much seen corporate affairs directors been able to do that over the years. They're very entrepreneurial, so they can obviously spot new opportunities. They really go after them. They've got huge energy around that. Then there's the, I guess, that they've got very much a very good navigator kind of instinct. So they know how to steer an organization through challenging internal and external environments. They also have this head coach characteristic, and that they can lead a brilliant team. They're preparing for the sort of future requirements. And finally, there's the empath. This is actually a really important characteristic of a corporate affairs leader. It's all about them being able to, combine EQ, relationship skills, you know, their connections. They understand emotions and perspectives. And that's actually probably the piece that probably the characteristic that's often hard to read from corporate affairs leaders.
Very true. Just then, so you actually need quite a big skill set. You need to be a kind of
absolutely
a fixer. You need to be a business person, an entrepreneur. You need to understand at least change management, if not be an advocate for it. You need to have HR, empathy, and you need to be a mentor.
Yeah.
So, it's quite a complex role, which is why I was saying that you probably need somebody who's very experienced if you're going to actually get into a role like this, because they need to bring a lot of things to the table, it sounds.
They do, absolutely. And I think, look, originally, you know, corporate affairs is definitely, it's as a function, you know, it's growing. So it was very much named and had the label of comms many years ago. And that's how, I guess, you know, people will first start their careers. They will come from, they could be in comms, they could be in media, they could be a journalist. So, and then they could be in public affairs. And then they eventually then sort of grow their skill set and into what is kind of more the broader kind of corporate affairs function. So look, it's absolutely a role that I think, you know, is so varied. It's so interesting. It's not easy. It's a tough gig. But I think it's fascinating, and I think it's a really rewarding career to follow.
Mm. Before I let you go, Susie, you have a conference coming up next week.
We do. So we're hosting the very first Corporate Affairs Summit next week, which is on Wednesday. This is the very first summit for the function, which is fantastic. And this has all come about through this summit has been hosted a number of times in London. Through the Corp Comms magazine. Helen Dunn is the founder and editor. So we had a conversation many years ago to bring the summit to Ireland, and it's finally happening next week. And we've got a really interesting programme with some terrific speakers. So I have to say, we're very excited about it.
Well, if nothing else, we seem to be becoming the summit capital of the world, because we're talking about two other summits on the programme today. But Susie, look, that is a fascinating insight into the world of corporate affairs. And thank you so much for taking the time to come in to us today. That was Susie Farrell, founder of Addison Recruitment.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mandy.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. Up next, we'll explore whether the European Central Bank has an identity problem. Stay with us. Welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. Now, you might remember that I mentioned earlier the European Central Bank Council convened at Mount Juliet earlier this week. It's expected to be their last meeting before that meeting in June. We're all expecting and hoping that interest rates will be reduced. Well, on the margins of that meeting, there was a little side discussion. It was about the staffing numbers within the European Central Bank, and a discussion that was happening about the number of staff that each country has. And here to tell us all about that and hopefully give us his views on what the European Central Bank said after their meeting this week, I'm delighted to be joined now by Martin Arnold, who is the Frankfurt Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. Martin, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Now, you might have seen in the aftermath of that summit meeting, or the retreat, that they had here in Ireland this week, that Christine Lagarde said that there's a strong likelihood of an interest rate cut when the Governing Council meets on June the 6th. Is that pretty much a done deal now, or should we still be cautioning, approaching June the 6th with caution?
I think it's almost a fait accompli. Really, it seems, you know, 95% certain that the ECB will start cutting interest rates on June the 6th. The signals that they've given are so strong that it would be very difficult for them to change course now. And Christine Lagarde's comments this week in the Irish media more or less confirmed that. Of course, there's always the possibility of some major shock, some geopolitical event, some massive shock that happens that causes, that changes everything and causes them to change their mind. But I think barring that, they will do as they have guided.
Mm. She specifically mentioned the energy crisis and supply chains as, you know, having calmed down now. That's something a broader picture of the European Union have been trying to deal with for quite some time. This is an indication, they feel at least, that they've got their arms around that problem now.
Yeah, she specifically said that she feels that inflation is now under control in the 20 countries that share the euro, including Ireland, of course. And inflation has come down quite a lot. It's fallen from above 10% at its peak back in 2022 down to an annual rate of 2.4%, the latest reading, which was for April. So their target is 2%, so it's still above that. And the ECB is forecasting that it won't get down to its target until next year. But they're confident enough in that, in their forecasts, to go ahead with cutting rates next month.
Mm. Well, we'll have to watch that space with interest. Martin, I want to turn to another issue, the one I mentioned also there, which you've been writing about this week, and it centres around unions within the European Central Bank calling for the introduction of nationality quotas on recruitment. But you might just take us way back and tell us how this started.
Yeah, OK. So this particular flare-up of the nationality issue at the ECB really started a couple of weeks ago with comments by the ECB's chief economist, Philip Lane.
Who is Irish.
Who is Irish, the former head of the Irish Central Bank, who is now on the executive board of the ECB, one of the most senior policymakers at the Eurozone Central Bank. And he didn't make these comments publicly, but they were reported by Neil Richmond, who spoke to an Irish newspaper and said that he had had a meeting with Philip Lane in Frankfurt and that Philip Lane had told him about the importance of encouraging more Irish people to apply for jobs at the ECB in order to maintain the level of Irish citizens within the ECB's staff numbers, because many of the Irish people who work there are going to approach the retirement age of 65 in the next decade. And so there's a fear that if more people don't apply to work at the Central Bank who are from Ireland, then Ireland's share of ECB staff will fall, and that will mean that Ireland has less influence within the ECB, and there'll be fewer people that the Irish government can pick up the phone easily to and talk to about issues of national concern.
Mm. And of course, we love a good old story where an insider said something to a minister and then a minister helpfully tells a journalist, and then all hell breaks loose in the aftermath, because what it looked like was the Philip Lane of the European Central Bank perhaps was suggesting that, you know, we need to get more Irish people in there so we have more access. Now, what Philip Lane has responded back is that he's encouraging all people to apply for jobs in the European Central Bank, and referencing a specific lecture that he gave in March at a School of Economics in France. And you could be benevolent and say, well, look, maybe he's just trying to safeguard against people leaving, and there is that recruitment issue that they constantly have to deal with. But it didn't really go down well with the staff inside, did it?
No. Well, I mean, this is a sensitive issue, and it has flared up from time to time. There's suspicions that I've heard from in the past that there are, you know, so many German citizens working at the ECB, and because the ECB is based in Frankfurt, that Germany has effective control or some kind of extra sway over the ECB because they're, you know, and there's always these kind of suspicions that there are national groups that have particular sway over particular parts of the ECB. And it's sensitive because when you join the central bank, you are supposed to leave your national identity behind, and you are supposed to work in the interests of all of the 20 countries that share the euro. So it shouldn't really matter where you're from, but of course it does.
Mm.
And so the staff committee and the unions that represent the staff of the ECB have had this as a hobby horse for a while. So when they saw these comments by Neil Richmond reporting what was said to him by Philip Lane, they jumped on it and wrote a letter to the executive board, to the president, Christine Lagarde, and her board members, including Philip Lane, saying they were disappointed to read this, but they feel that it showed the need for introducing these nationality quotas to ensure that no nationality was, you know, too dominant or underrepresented within the staff of the ECB. Now, the ECB responded to this by saying that they didn't think that quotas were necessarily a good idea. What they said exactly was, we have no nationality quotas. We hire colleagues based on their abilities and merits. Now, they do take nationality diversity into consideration when they have, say, two candidates for a job, and they're both of equal qualifications, equally suitable. Then they look at things like gender, they look at nationality to try and sort of take these other things into account. So, but the union would like them to go further and actually have a kind of quotas to try and rebalance out these things, because some countries have, you know, an oversized presence within the ECB of their citizens within the ECB staff, and other countries seem to be underweight. So that, you know, is not an ideal situation. I think they would prefer to be more in balance than they currently are. But it's difficult because, you know, they can't force people to apply for jobs at the ECB.
Yeah, but it does lead to the question about balance overall, and this notion, at least, that you leave your country affiliations and allegiances behind and that size doesn't matter. But of course, when you look at something like the European Commission and the commissioner's appointments, size does matter, because you're not going to see a small country appointed to a really big job, for example, not in all cases. So is there any principle there that people could work from, say, within the ECB, that actually does highlight and impose some sort of balance when it comes to national representation?
Well, this is what the staff committee argue in the letter that they've sent to the ECB board. They point out that the European Commission has a system in place which identifies a threshold under which they must make specific efforts to hire and promote people of a certain nationality in order to retain what they call a suitable balance of nationalities within the European Commission, to prevent any one nation citizens from gaining, you know, an outsized presence. So they argue, the staff committee argued, that the ECB should copy that. It doesn't look likely, but I guess you never say never. I mean, a lot of the ECB's rules, like on, for instance, how they decide what pay increases to give their staff, are similar to those that are at the European Commission. So they're not, it's not impossible that they could be tempted to follow this, especially, I think, if the imbalances of nationality within their staff, if those continue to, become worse, or they become larger, then that is something that I think they might look at. But for now, I don't get the sense that there's any urgency to change the rules within the ECB. I think they just what they might do is they could, for instance, and I think they're already doing this to a certain extent, is they could look at putting more emphasis on going to, say, recruitment fairs or, you know, graduate days of certain, suitable universities like economics schools in those countries where they know the nationalities are underweight, to try and encourage more people from those countries to come and apply for jobs at the ECB. Having any hard and fast rules.
Yeah. I certainly think that now the spotlight is on this issue, they'll be more acutely aware of that. It might seem like a marginal issue, but it is a very interesting one nonetheless, because the ECB is so powerful. Martin, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today and to take us through that. That was Martin Arnold, the Frankfurt Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. Now, lots more to come on today's show as tech leaders, politicians and business people descended on Killarney this week for the inaugural Global Irish Summit. Charlie Taylor from the Business Post was there, and he's going to be here with us after the break to tell us what went down in Killarney. And this. Well, things can only get better for Rishi Sunak, or could they be about to get a whole lot worse? That's coming up after this short break. And now it's time for this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
It was all happening down in Killarney as the first Global Economic Summit took place. And what was dominating discussions there, according to Charlie Taylor from the Business Post, our next guest was AI. Charlie, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mandy. It's great to catch up with you. And you're dead right there. I mean, I suppose, you know, the conference mirrored what's going on everywhere, really, is that there's only one topic of conversation a lot of the time, and that's AI. And, you know, it switches between sort of, you know, is it going to destroy humanity to, you know, will it bring this beautiful utopia in which we live forever after, or that kind of thing, you know? So, I mean, you know, there were all sides represented in the discussion this week. And whatever the topic that was coming up for conversation, at some stage or another, AI ended up creeping into it.
Mm. And actually, I just want to go back a little bit, because we're talking about a few summits that took place in Ireland on the show this week. What is the Global Economic Summit? I know that the Business Post have something to do with the organising of it. So what is its intention? Who was there? What were they trying to achieve?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was the first time it's been run. And essentially, I mean, if you think of Davos, you know, the World Meeting in Switzerland and discuss the big issues of the day. This is, I suppose, you could look at that as a sort of Irish version of something of that, or of that sort of goal, at least, that looking to achieve. So we had a lot of great people, you know, whether it's politicians, technologists, artists, all of these great people come, you know, all come en masse to Killarney during the week to discuss a lot of the issues and to look for solutions. You know, I mean, I think the key is that the plan is that this is not just a talking shop where people get together and say, aren't we deadly? You know, it's the idea that there will be real solutions that people can take away with them and use in their work, in their, you know, in their play, whatever way that will be.
Mm. And what type of people were there? I mean, we've heard Minister McGrath's comments about AI, and we'll come back to that in a few moments to discuss what it means for business and politics and all of that. But who else was attending? Who else was speaking?
Yeah, we had the likes of Jim Sheridan, the director, who you'll know very well. There was Prince Albert of Monaco, former a Ukrainian prime minister. You know, I mean, there was a bit, you know, plenty of technology people as well. You know, there's lots of people from Google and the like. So, I mean, it was well represented. You know, there was discussions across things like energy, the environment, politics. You know, there was plenty of congressmen there. There was a good, heavy US influence out there. So a few former congressmen. were in attendance. And then, of course, there was plenty of techies as well.
So. Mm. And what about off the stage? I mean, every year on this program, we cover Davos, and I love getting someone who's, mingling behind the scenes to find out what's happening. What about that networking opportunity? Is there a large amount of that that's going on down there?
Absolutely. You could hear people like work in the room very hard, and lots of introductions being done, and people getting on very well. It's kind of relaxed. I suppose people, it's away from the city. It's, it's a beautiful environment at the Europe Hotel. So very relaxed, people having barbecues and big gala dinners and the like. And, a real sort of time, I suppose, for people to kind of check out of their regular life and the pressures of that, to then come together and kind of like think more in depth about the bigger issues that affect all of us.
Mm. So look, what I'm hearing here is that this is the first and you hope to grow it. And maybe, it's not just a summit. It's not just a talking shop. It's to try and connect people together.
Absolutely. That's really the key of it. And I suppose that was a key reason why technology was front and center at it. Whether we like it or not, technology is a huge integral part of our lives now. So, and we're hugely dependent on it. So, that was a prime topic for conversation throughout, of like how it impacts on us, how we can help use it for good. All of those sort of things were up for discussion.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things that struck me reading your reports on it. We tend to often see AI through the prism of fear, and I don't think the Minister of Finance did anything to dissuade us of that when he said this could cost us 30,000 jobs or one third of people could be made redundant, whatever the metric was. Mm. But the discussions down there seem to be largely a lot more positive than what I've heard before.
Absolutely. I mean, and I would say, yes, as the week started off, I suppose, with a sort of like, oh, my God, when you hear those stats from McGrath, I think it was actually 2/3 of jobs. And not that they would necessarily go, but they would be affected by AI. But we do need to kind of caveat that by saying, look, it's not necessarily all bad. We don't have weavers anymore and we don't have lift operators. As technology comes to us, roles change. We get new roles. We've got new jobs like machine learning specialists, all that sort of stuff coming on. So, we are just in a period of change. Paul Doherty, who's the chief technology officer at Accenture, for example, when he started his keynote speech, he said that businesses need to set themselves up for continual change. Mm. Just the amount of change, differences, just the amount of things that are going to be thrown up by AI, both good and bad, He was really, it's interesting because he was speaking a day after McGrath talked about jobs and potential threats to that. He said he saw, the talk of jobs being lost as a result of AI as a bit of a distraction from the real issue. And he was saying about how, there's a lot of good things to come from AI. And I suppose one of the things we need to do is to stop being afraid of it.
And that's really at the core, isn't it? Really, no one really knows where this is headed, and that breeds fear. Yet Doherty also said that this could unlock $10.3 billion worth of potential economic investment and value for Ireland when you look at the skill set that we have here and our ability to adapt to different opportunities as we have in the past. So that spirit of kind of embracing something is not new to Ireland. We did it with the electronic sector years ago, the pharma sector years ago. Why not AI now?
Absolutely. And it has to be said, and this was repeated by a number of people at the event, was that Ireland is in a really good position. We have, obviously, all the tech companies are here. Irish companies themselves, we've got a number of really promising companies in the AI space. The government has been quick to recognize it as being something critical to our future. And has set up, the AI Advisory Council, which is kind of advising it on, what we need to know as we tread carefully through the act. Organizations and politicians in Ireland were very key to the AI Act, which is the first piece of, comprehensive legislation regulating AI in the world, and is expected to be the sort of blueprint, I suppose, for legislation in other jurisdictions on this. We're setting the ground rules very, very well here. We can't tell the future. We don't know what's going to happen exactly. But, it's quite an exciting time. It's an era of possibilities as well as, concerns because technology changes. If you think back even, I suppose, to I don't know, 30, 40 years ago when the internet became a thing. I remember kind of 1990s, people were kind of afraid in the way that they are now and kind of like, oh, what's going to happen with the internet? And, you know, if you look at it, you know, we've seen both good and bad from it, you know. So, I mean, it is just, you know, at some point it will be integral to our life. It will be integrated into our world and we'll maybe not think of it in such the way that we do now. It will just be part of our everyday.
Yeah, for sure. And what about ESG, Charlie? Did that feature down there? Because I know it's something that's occupying quite a number of businesses now who are struggling with some elements or another of that, those targets, that compliance that, that business have to adhere to now.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I mean, I suppose ESG and tech, and in particular AI, were the key areas that came up for discussion. You know, again, the people were largely positive about it. You know, people are not kind of, you know, but I do say this in a way that they weren't sort of saying, oh, everything's just wonderful. You know, it wasn't sort of like the Lego movie where everyone's joining hands and singing everything is awesome. It was very much not that. But I suppose a sort of realistic take of like, you know, that there is the potential to make a difference in a positive manner here, whether it's on ESG, whether it's in terms of, you know, healthcare, all of these things that are coming up, AI plays into that, other technologies play to that. Some of it is about the need to change our mindsets on these as much as anything else. It's not just about getting a technology and doing this thing. It's like we also need to kind of think, what can we do? How can we, you know, do things differently that will bring about real change?
Well, Charlie, listen, I think it's a great idea. It sounds like it was a success and great that it was happening in Killarney. Long may that continue. But thank you very much for taking the time to bring us up to speed on what happened this week at the Global Economic Summit. That was Charlie Taylor of the Business Post. Thank you. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to the UK because we were expecting an election to be called there for later in the year. But the UK Prime Minister hit the escape button early and called an election for the 4th of July. Will this be seen as a really bold and brave move or an act of folly? Well, Mark Paul, the London correspondent for the Irish Times, saw how all the drama unfolded on Wednesday. And I'm delighted to say that he joins me on the line now. Mark, it's never dull over there, is it?
Never a dull moment over here, Mandy, and certainly it wasn't a dull moment this week on Wednesday when, as you say, Rishi Sunak reached for the escape button or the eject button, or maybe it was the panic button. We don't know. But what he did do was stun Westminster. I mean, on Wednesday, just to tell you a little bit about how that day played out, I mean, Wednesday is Prime Minister's Questions Day. I mean, that's the big set piece of the day at noon. But from early that morning, they were rumbling, sort of election rumblings that we've heard before, and people just missed at the time. And they said, look, oh, we've heard all of this before. But it became quite apparent quite quickly that this was different. And news filtered back that David Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, had turned around his plane and was flying back from a trip to Albania. And there was a cabinet meeting scheduled for later on that evening. Everybody had to attend. All of the ministers, I mean, had to attend. And they didn't know what was happening. And then, right in the middle of PMQ's Prime Minister's Questions, Stephen Flynn, the leader in Westminster of the Scottish National Party, put it directly to Rishi Sunak. He asked him if he was going to call an early summer election, and slipping into Scottish slang, he asked him if he was feared, if he was afraid. And Rishi Sunak didn't give a straight answer. And in the briefing that takes place after that, for reporters after that, in the kind of bells of the House of Commons, his team didn't do anything to try and dampen down the speculation. And I think from that moment on, people knew something was coming. And then at 5 o'clock, as we all saw afterwards, Rishi Sunak walked out into the pouring rain and made his announcement.
Look, if you've worked behind the scenes in politics, the one thing a leader has going for them when it comes to elections is they control the timing of the announcement. And I think, you know, what happened on Wednesday is just symbolic of Rishi Sunak and even the Conservative Party, because it didn't even look like he was in control of that on the day. There was a disastrous, podium moment, which he did well, I think, to hold it all together in actually announcing the election. But there was no sense of, I'm prepared, I'm ready, this is a determined effort. But like now, having had a couple of days to think about it and looking at it rationally, Mark, why do you think he chose to go this early? What are the elements, do you think, made him think this is a better time than November or the autumn or winter, as he had previously alluded to?
I think the simple reason that Rishi Sunak decided to go early was because he and his team calculated that things just weren't going to improve. It just wasn't going to get any better than this, and there was a real risk that things could deteriorate over the summer and actually get worse. I mean, if you kind of weigh it up, the things that could have went wrong over the summer were, okay, you could have had another summer of more of the small boats crisis, of immigrants landing on England's southeastern shores. You would have had another summer of Nigel Farage teasing the Tory party with a willy wonky question about his running. There was also a slight risk around the economy and inflation figures. On the day that Rishi Sunak called the election, inflation had come down to 2.3%. But it was still slightly higher than a lot of economists had expected. And there was always a possibility that if it started to tick back up again, even by a tiny bit, it would remove one of his entire electioneering platforms. So he's decided to go early in the hope of kind of getting ahead of that. And also, again, another critical factor is, I mean, red meat for a Tory party comes in the form of tax cuts. And it has become apparent in the most recent fiscal data that there is probably no room for Tory tax cuts in October in some sort of an autumn statement budget. And if they can't wait around for tax cuts, I think they calculated, well, why will we bother waiting around at all? Let's just go for it and see where we end up. And I think that's what they've done, for better or for worse. They've jumped over the edge of a cliff and hoping that they'll land on the Belvedere tree or something on the way down. I don't know. But it is a real gamble. It's a real gamble. And I don't think he had many cards left to play.
No, I think when you work that all out, the 2% inflation announcement on Wednesday is the thinnest of thin positive things that he could maybe cling to. So you've listened for the last number of days about what their proposition is going into this election now. What's his message to the electorate?
His message to the electorate that I can discern so far from obviously from the day on Wednesday when the election was called, and then from following up to Derbyshire the next morning for his first campaign event, his pitch at this stage of the campaign is based on two things, really. It's based on the economy and it's based on national security. And immigration hasn't quite come to the fore in the debate yet. I mean, he's talking about the economy, about the fact that the economy is growing, that wages have been growing faster than prices, I think, for about 10 months, and that inflation is down to 2.3%, and that you know, there's no unemployment problem with Britain and so on, and that people are starting to feel better. And you could feel that, the beginnings of that in British society. People, I mean, when I arrived over here first in January of last year, I mean, everybody was miserable about the cost of living. And that conversation has seeped away. And you do see, I wouldn't say a feel-good factor, but Britain is only just out of a recession, literally only just out of a recession. So there's no feel-good factor, but certainly people are looking up a little bit more at the economy. So there's that. And then there's the element of national security. I think his pitch to the British voters is based around the fact that, you know, he's prepared to increase defence spending. He can be trusted, you know, to support, for example, Ukraine in a time of war in Europe. He can be trusted to support, and this would be a divisive thing, but he's trusted to support Israel in the Middle East, and that he kind of portrays himself as somebody who is strong on national security, and Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, as somebody who would be weak on it. Now, allied to that, as a kind of a sidecar onto the motorcycle of that argument, he throws in immigration and a small boats crisis, which hasn't really evolved yet as a big issue on its own. Because what emerged the day after he called the election campaign, and what emerged in his first round of broadcast interviews, was that actually his prime immigration policy, the Rwanda deportation policy for illegal migrants, no planes will take off for Rwanda before the election. So his set piece policy for the 6 or 8 months leading up to the election actually won't have come into force yet before the election starts. So he's moved the conversation away from that and more towards things that people are actually interested in terms of when you rank the priorities of British voters, the NHS, the economy, the cost of living and stuff like that are all higher up the agenda than immigration.
Interesting is two arguments in the initial days, the economy and security. And I've heard some of the British MPs out talking about this is no time for a novice, alluding to Keir Starmer being a novice, something I think Gordon Brown used many years ago as well. But, you know, really, Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, they've been, you know, carrying out over the last number of months in particular, this Ming Vo's policy of just steady as you go, hold on to the lead that they're having in the polls at the moment and don't do anything wrong. Do you think we're likely to see a change in that pace now? Are they going to have to start articulating more about what's on offer from the Labour Party when they get into government, which is looking highly likely?
Yes, I think there's an understanding of that right at the very top of the Labour Party, that, you know, there's only so far you're going to get by saying, look, we're not the other fellow. And we're not the other shower. And that's why you should put us in government. And eventually they would have to come out with more of their own policies. I mean, they, you know, kind of when the speculation was mounting on Wednesday afternoon that an election might be called, in that briefing where Rishi Sunak's spokespeople didn't dampen down the speculation, in the briefing that immediately followed with Labour's people, they said, look, we're completely ready. They said they had their manifestos already printed, even though nobody has seen them yet. So one would assume that if you've got a manifesto already printed, there must be stuff in it, right? They're going to talk more about what they intend to do. It takes a couple of days, I think, for a British general election campaign to actually kick into gear. So we haven't really seen Labour at full pelt yet, or the Tories, because they have a couple of days afterwards of what they call over here the wash-up, which is where you have to tidy up the legislative agenda. So anything that was advanced at a legislative stage, you try and get it to ram it through if you can. And anything that you can't, you abandon. Any procedural votes that you've got to have really quickly, you have them. So the MPs haven't all scattered their constituencies yet. I mean, as we speak, I'm currently sitting in the atrium in PCH, Portcullis House, which is the working part of the parliamentary estate, kind of across the road beneath the tunnel from the House of Commons. And I mean, I saw a minute ago Priti Patel walk by me. I had a brief chat myself with Steve Baker and the Minister of State for Northern Ireland. So there are MPs still knocking about the place, tidying things up, getting ready for the wash-up, and before they go back to their constituencies. And then when Labour really start to campaign and campaign hard, then I think we'll start to see a lot of policy announcements. I mean, I was at a briefing last week with a very senior member of the Labour Party, about their pledge cards. They put out, in their words, a down payment on what they're going to argue to the voters with this pledge card of six promises based around stuff like immigration and the economy and basically crime and more teachers and so on. So you're going to see that fleshed out a little bit more. These six pledges in a pledge card that they've handed out, it's literally a card. It's a credit card size card that they hand out to voters. It's very Tony Blair. It's very 1997.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it is, despite all the technology, it's certainly back to basic when it comes to campaigning. That won't change. Mark, you've got a very interesting 6 weeks ahead of you over there, and I hope that we'll talk to you again as the campaign moves on. But thank you very much for taking the time to be with us on what is a very busy week for you. That was Mark Paul, the London correspondent of the Irish Times. Thank you. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And what we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of today's guests, and thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunter on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments about today's items, do get in touch with us on takingstock@newstalk.com. Stay tuned. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock, with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.